like to call the meeting of AMAT to order. Do we have a quorum?
We do.
Do we have any audience participation? Okay. The minutes, you should have received a copy of the minutes. Do we have any questions or discussion? We'll need a motion to accept the minutes from the
Move
September.
To adopt.
Second.
Any discussion? Okay, all in favor of passing the minutes for September 25th, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Number three, staff reports, and we will give this to Mr. Segedine.
Thank you. The financial progress report for AMATS is attachment 3A that was in your folder, and that shows the status of our budget through November 30th. Pleased to report that we're right where we should be budget-wise. We're into the fifth month of the fiscal year, and we've expended 40% of the budget, which is right where we should be. And with that, we recommend approval of the financial progress report.
Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Sorry.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We have the item B under number three is technical progress report. Curtis?
Thank you. First, welcome to our new space. We will be here for the next year. I did want to let you know we were talking to some people that work here that right now it's really easy with parking because the students are mostly have gone home for the semester, but in the next couple months, we might be parking on the other side of the bridge, so you enter here still, but the parking might be a little bit further than it was today, because I guess the students like to take the sweet spots, so that might be something we have to live with. But for the technical progress report, just to update you a little bit on what's going on from the federal level, there have been a couple of proposals when it comes to new transportation legislation. Two of them are quite different. One is a House bill that proposes increasing the gas tax by 15 cents to a maximum of 33.4 cents. That bill is currently in committee in the House. Similarly, there is another bill that's both in the House and the Senate that is actually looking at a devolution of the gas tax, which would be bringing it down from its current 18 cents to roughly 3.7 cents. With the idea that the state would then would apply for some block grants, and then eventually it would be the state's responsibility for the highway system. So basically getting rid of the federal system. I think the biggest thing about that is that it shows that there are still definitely a couple of groups that are way apart on what we think needs to happen with transportation. The bill expires on October of 2014, so we do have... We will be getting to a point where something is going to need to be done this year. And I think unlike in years past, or like in years past, that the tax or the gas tax fund is going to basically be insolvent by the end of 2014. So it will be something that our staff will be monitoring quite a bit, especially moving into 2014. From a staff perspective or staff work, we have awarded two connected communities planning grants, one to Montrose, one to the city of Barberton. Both those were working to get a consultant under contract, so those are moving forward. And then also, you'll see a little bit about pedestrian crash, or I'm sorry, bicycle crashes today and a bike crash report. We will be working on a similar pedestrian crash report and have more data to share with you on that in the coming future. But with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Any questions for Curtis? Thanks, Curtis. Item C under number three is Victor, the federal funds report.
Thank you. ODOT has officially accepted the Ohio Statewide Urban CMAQ program policy. And this is the new policy that's going to guide the selection of projects, CMAQ projects at the state level that we've been talking about the last few months. This process will start, I believe it's May, the coming year, at this MDO level, similar to what we've seen before. We'll solicit for projects. Sponsors will fill out those applications, send them back to us, the tax GMP subcommittee will review them, score them based on this new policy. And then by, I think it's September, August or September of next year, it's Well, first of all, it'll come back to this committee for final approval of which projects we'll send out to the state. That'll go down there August or September, and then that committee down there will prepare with the rest of the projects in the state, and then by the end of the calendar year 2014, there should be a list of projects that are being funded through this new statewide CMAC funding. And that'll be for projects in fiscal year 2018 and possibly 2019. New round of project funding. The TAC TFP subcommittee met earlier this week. There were 132 projects that were submitted for funding, requesting $141 million. We want to break down to that. Under the STP funding program, there were 38 applications requesting $98 million. Under the transportation alternatives or TAP program, there was 26 applications requesting $11 million. And under resurfacing, there were 68 applications requesting $32 million. Originally, when we set out to do this new round of funding, what we typically do is go out for the next 2 years to open funding. If you recall, in the last round of funding, we pulled the program. We were going to go out for 18 and 19, but 18 is pretty much all well spoken for because of our open program 2 years ago. So the thought is to go and use the funding up also this year in 2020. So that will give us 20-some million to be able to work with. Again, the overall request was $141 million. So the subcommittee, like I said, we did meet earlier this week, looked at some of the scoring and the ranking. We've got some things to do, and we'll reconvene right after the holidays, and then the recommendations coming out of that committee should come back to here in January for final approval. And that's all I have on this item.
Okay.
Any questions
for Victor? Thank you, Victor. Under old business, I understand that our ODOT representative, Mr. Yanko, would like to pass out some information.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Going to pass them both ways. I think we got enough here. But what's coming out right now is our new program resource guide. This is a smaller elected official version. The other version is pretty big and pretty long. It has a lot more details. A couple things I want to point out. This one, if you go to our website under Division of Planning, you'll get this, but this truly is a great one-stop shop to find out about the programs and what we basically can do to work with you. Everybody does have it on page 9, Turnpike Mitigation Program. If you have not heard, it was announced, there was a rollout in early part of December. Part of the law or part of the bill that went through where we were able to leverage the bonds or the funding for the Turnpike said that we were going to mitigate problems and work with the Turnpike Commission, we being ODOT, for communities that were within 1 mile north and south of the Turnpike. For the AMATS area, that is about, outside of the county engineers, it's about 8 communities, from all the way to the west, Windham Township to Ridgefield on the east. We had the meeting, it was not that great attended, but by the end of January in Streetsboro, and their engineer have actually applied already, they've worked with us. This program is out there. It's a lot like the same program that we do for track projects. If you have any questions or you feel you're within that 1 mile, let us know. On page 10 of the application, which I didn't print out, it specifically says the ODOT T&E administrator, local, with Jim Kinnick sitting next to me, know about it. So you have to work with us and through us. And then also after that, it asks if an MPO is involved with the AMAT. So we're going to be sending the link and more information to Jason for the communities that are affected. Again, Streetsboro, Freedom Township, Shalersville, Windham, Boston Heights, Hudson, Ridgefield, Boston Township, and Ridgefield Township. Please talk to us if you feel that the Turnpike has created a problem or there's a mitigation situation you need to look at. We already have meetings, like I say, set up with Streetsboro before that the closing is set for January 31st. I think everything has to be in by where the projects will be awarded in spring of 14. It's $5 million a year, which isn't a lot, but it's also there for perpetuity until we get everything that needs to be fixed that are affected by it. So, again, if you can make meetings, we understand. If not, please work with us, and again, from the Turnpike standpoint, this is the start of the conversation going back for what they're saying is 60 years, that if there are issues, we need to sit down and talk about them, hopefully we can resolve. Back to the program resource guide, again, we'll send the link out. either Gary or Jason, to let you know where you can get these. Everything we always pass out is also online. There's a bigger version of this, but it's a very good quote at the end of this book. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Any other old business?
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
When you say Wyndham, do you say Wyndham Village and then Wyndham Township too?
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah. Go first through the township and go to smack down.
Okay.
Thank you, Turnpike Authority.
Yep.
Number five on your agenda, new business. Item A is AMAPS, the state of our region's transportation infrastructure. Nate.
Such a small number allows us to really use a laser focus on the particular settings.
going forward. Now, in many of our other plans and documents, we like to benchmark the AMAPS region to similar metropolitan regions. A difficulty that we discovered is that other neighboring states use vastly different methodologies to determine pavement condition ratings. So we thought it was best to just go ODOT produce a standard data for pavement condition ratings. So what we did was benchmark ourselves to all of the other major metropolitan areas throughout the state of Ohio. So we had a good apples-to-apples comparison. These are all the communities that are the metropolitan areas, and they've been sorted by the order of percentage in good descending. When looking at all Ohio metropolitan areas, the major counties in the AMAPS region kind of fall up in the middle of the pack. A good thing is that when you isolate just Northeast Ohio metropolitan areas, the AMAPS, the two principal AMAPS counties, are at the head of the pack, which is a good thing. So that's something we monitor going forward. Okay, the second part of the report focuses on bridges, and just real briefly, the report goes into quite a bit of detail, not only the pavement condition rating, gathering of that information, but also about the bridge rating systems. But there's a broad way to look at the bridges, and then we kind of drill down from that going on. The first one, there's an overall bridge condition rating that ODOT assigns to every bridge in the region. There are from 9, which is an excellent condition, down to 0, which is a completely failed bridge. There are none here. But anything rated 4 or below is considered in poor condition. So when we look at the bridges in the region, we can benchmark ourselves in this regard to all the bridges across the nation. The federal government produces universal bridge rating data, so this one can actually do an apples-to-apples comparison with all bridges, the entire population, basically. So, in the other categories, the AMAPS region fares very well, outweighing the national average by a significant amount. And likewise, in the lower numbers in the rating system, we're underweighted, so that's a good sign. Now, as I said, you can drill down into the bridges, and there's basically two sub-classifications of bridges. The first are functionally obsolete bridges. These bridges, there's nothing wrong with them structurally, but they just do not meet current design standards. Perhaps the vehicle clearances are a little bit low, the lanes may be more narrow than we would want in a modern bridge. There's nothing technically wrong with them structurally. The category that we're more concerned with are the structurally deficient bridges. To fall into that category, that means at least one of the three sections of the bridge, the deck, substructure, or superstructure, must be rated 4 or less. And those are the bridges that there for this, the purposes of this report, considering it's not in a state of good repair. Just because they fall on the structure deficient list does not mean they're in danger of imminent collapse or anything like that. They could certainly be shut down or put into light duty before they ever got to that state. But nevertheless, they're bridges that we certainly want to keep an eye on. So just looking at structurally deficient bridges, there are 71 in our area. The data is from 2010, so there's a bit of a lag. 10 of those, we already have projects in the TIP, and there are more forthcoming with the ODOT's Ohio Bridge Partnership Program. So that number should be climbing in just the next few years. But as of the data we have right now, 71 bridges, or 7.2% of the region's bridges, are structurally deficient. We also broke that down by county, and unlike the other analysis we did, Portage County does have a slightly higher number of bridges that do fall within the structurally deficient classifications. That's something we certainly want to just keep an eye on in the future. But basically, of the 984 bridges that we analyzed in our region, 913 of them would be in a state of good repair. And then once again, benchmarking them to both these subcategories to the national averages. When we look at functionally obsolete bridges, AMAPS actually is quite a bit higher than the national average, by about 10%. We attribute that to being, you know, a more industrial area. The average bridge age in our region is 49 years. Clearly, many of them were designed before more modern standards were put into effect. The more important of the two that we've analyzed, the structurally efficient bridges, we actually fare fairly well, once again, to the national average, about coming in 5% under the national average. So, as I mentioned in the report, there's a couple summary pages in there. It goes into quite a bit of detail if I need one thing to do the same thing.
That's what we have on this. We did set this up so that would be replicable, the data. So we envision in the future every 2 or 3 years when new data sets come out, we'd like to recreate this and, you know, use this first one as the benchmark and just see, you know, we can judge the effectiveness of our transportation investments by seeing where we're falling, where we may or may not need to these things. So that's all I have. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
In the report, do you put the date the data is from?
Okay. Yeah, and it does vary. When ODOT does PCRs and bridge conditions, they tend to do it like a by a county, and there's a rotation. So some's from 2009, some's from 2010. It kind of rotates. Yes, try to document them. And put them as to when all the data was available.
What truly usually happens with railroads, because that's also transportation infrastructure, and also public transit facilities. We've got the transit center, we've got a number of buildings, bus garages, same thing with park. How is that usually handled?
Something we definitely thought about. As far as we look for like availability of data for this first round, this report could certainly broaden it into and find good ways to quantify, will it just capture kind of assigned grade to the infrastructure. One reason we thought, you know, generally just judging the federally classified highways, that's what the buses run on, so it's kind of, you know, that's what they, it kind of judges the conditions that they're living under. As far as the individual assets of the transit agencies, we could certainly try to find a way to quantify that and everything. Railroad bridges we pulled out because we don't really have anything, I mean, AMS doesn't have any direct impact on those. I think largely they're, I don't even know a whole lot about the maintenance of them. I think the railroad maintains a lot of them. Maybe there's help from them. I'm not really sure. Certainly, this is the first attempt at this, and we'd be happy to entertain ways to broaden it and get better.
Yeah, I think it's pretty really good redundancy. Of course, ODOT is, you know, help to support a lot of railroad infrastructure over the years with some of the clearance programs that CSX and Norfolk Southern have recently embarked upon. And certainly, federal dollars come to the metro and part of for a lot of our buildings as well as vehicles. FTA is requiring the transit system to become much more attentive to asset maintenance. And we are going through the process as our number of transit systems across the country in upgrading our ability to measure quality of our facilities. So we look forward to working with you to try and incorporate some of the data that we generate for those reports for FTA into the region's reports.
And Rich, we would be glad to work with both you and PARTA to maybe produce a similar report or an addendum to this that would focus on public transit. I think especially if you look at the buses, our infrastructure too, and looking at the age of the fleet and some of the vehicle replacement data. Nate happens to be one of the transit planners on the staff too, so maybe we could set up a meeting with yourself or your staff and PARTA and talk about a way that we could produce a comparable report.
Great. Thank you. Good job.
Does the FTA regulate those bridges? I mean, as far as inspect them?
The Federal Railroad Administration inspects the bridges at Metro Homes, yes. That they inspect tracks as well.
All bridges? River bridges? And how do they get inspected?
We have to bring an FRA certified inspector onto our property several times a year. That's required by the Federal Railroad Administration.
Do we have an increase in railroad traffic right now?
Metro's, well, I can only speak for Metro's rail traffic. It's been fairly stable. It has not increased a lot, although we've been talking to some companies that are interested in trying to move more rail products. So we'd like to see this increase. But I think because of the fracking, what I have been using Class 1, Norfolk Southern, CSX, they have been moving a lot more aggregates and sand. So their business is up. And again, as they finish these clearance projects, we're starting to see a lot of double stack traffic coming through Akron.
We've had increased interest in companies who want access to rail more than any of the time I've been with the county. So this year I've seen more requests from people who are looking for sites that have rail access. So seems to be increased interest.
Great.
CSX or somebody like that would have representatives of the planning organizations.
We have had a rail representative typically on our technical advisory committee. There's been a gentleman from the Wheeling and Lake Erie in the past that represents the rail industry. And I think we've tried in the past to reach out more. Sometimes the railroads will have varying degrees of interest in collaborating on stuff like this, but we can keep trying.
Any other questions for Nate? Thank you, Nate. Item B, under number 5, would be attachment 5B, Dave, it's bicycle-related crashes.
Okay, thank you. This is another first for AMAT. I come up here and I talk about vehicular safety a lot and present crash reports. And during my presentation, sometimes I mentioned, well, we had 331 bicycle crashes that involved a bicycle in the last 3 years, but we've never really taken a closer look at what's happening. So this is also an attempt to try to look a little closer at those particular accidents. The purpose of this report is to examine why and how the crashes are happening. It's not a list of specific locations, and it's another tool to help us determine where our efforts can be directed and our funds used most efficiently. A little bit about biking in the AMATS area. The biking culture here, at least in my opinion, is mostly one of recreation rather than transportation. That doesn't mean it can never be changed. I think that's just where we're at right now. We have over 100 miles of multi-purpose trails. And since 2000, we've $12 million in funding for these trails. And this is really, I think, a really, really great asset that we have. And I love using what we have. And it's safe. There's a few conflicts with traffic when you use the trails. Unfortunately, the trails do present some connectivity issues. I cannot really use the towpath to ride down to the local grocery store and buy a few things. Bicycle crashes differ from vehicular-only crashes in a few ways. First of all, there's a much higher percentage of injured bicycle-related crashes, 78% of those involving injury, and it's 25% for most other crashes. They occur more randomly, they're less concentrated. It is difficult to pull out specific locations where a lot are happening. Possibly you can identify a corridor. And something that I discovered when I was putting this together, I never thought much about this, is bike riders are the only road users that don't need a license or really any kind of training. And a reason I bring this to your attention is riders that are under 16, and quite a few of them are involved in these incidents, but riders under 16 just may not be cognitive of the rules that that they need to be following. Here's a map of where the bike-related crashes happened in the last 3 years, between 2010 and 2012. As you can see, they're rather spread out. They do vary somewhat with population density because there's more vehicles, more bikes, and obviously more chances of conflicts. The last 3 years, fortunately, the number of crashes has been declining a little bit. If you go back another 3 years, you can see it's kind of up and down. If you did a trend line, it would almost be a straight line across the graph. the way we did this, first of all, we came up with the crashes that involved a bike from the Ohio Department of Public Safety, and then we obtained document numbers for each crash, and then we went to the Department of Public Safety website, and we actually downloaded every police report and actually looked at every report. The first big cut was we divided them into two groups, actually three groups. Those were the rider was faulted, those were the vehicle driver was faulted, and there was another group where the fault was unknown. He said, she said, and or it was a strange circumstance, and we just couldn't figure it out. And then crash types within each group was compiled. And this is what we ended up with. 184 bike crashes, 184 where the bike rider was faulted, or 56%. 104 where the vehicle driver was faulted, or 31%. And then 36 or 11% where it was unknown. And then there were a few we just couldn't find the report. Now, when we dive deeper into this, there was a general conclusion that I pulled out of this. The first one was when the bike rider was faulted, almost half the riders were under 16. And when the vehicle was faulted, most of the riders were older. The most common crashes when the bike rider was faulted, the most common one was they just crossed in front of a vehicle. Here's a couple diagrams. These I actually cut out of a police report. These were actually from a police report. As you can see in this first one, the rider, I think, did a U-turn and he cut right in front of the car. And then in this one, came off the sidewalk in front of the car. The next most common type of bike rider fault crash was they ran a stop sign or a red light. Here's a couple more examples directly from police reports. Both of these are running stop signs and actually running into the vehicle. When the vehicle was involved, the most common occurrence was the vehicle hit a bike at an intersection. And as you can see, this pop of the car just turned right in front of the bike. Bikes are have a very narrow profile, they're harder to see, and a lot of drivers just aren't watching for them. And then also down here, this is common, where a biker might be on the sidewalk and the car just turns, makes a right turn. Right in front of them. When the vehicle was faulted, a couple of common types of crashes were hitting bikes at driveways. Here's one where the car, once again, like at the intersection, the car turns right and turns right in front of the bike. And then here's one where the car's backing out, doesn't see them. Doesn't see the bike and backs right into them. Concluding, the most common location, regardless of who's at fault, of a vehicle crash was at an intersection. 146 or 44% of these incidents happen at intersections. Many times it's the bike or the vehicle just not doing what they're supposed to do. Some other conclusions, regardless of fault, 134 bike riders were under the age of 16. That's 40%. 40% of these crashes had bike riders under 16. We noticed that biking against traffic and biking on the sidewalk were common and contributed to many of the crashes. And we discovered that drivers need to be more aware of bikers and watch out for them. And education for bike riders and drivers is definitely needed. And one more thing, the AMATS section of the AMATS website is a section of the AMATS website is called Switching Gears, excuse me, and has a lot of information about biking and
has a real good section about bike safety, so that's a real good place to go to if you're not sure about the rules or you want to learn more about how to ride on the highway. That's a real good resource for you. And that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions? Yes.
In these findings, will you send those to the state to possibly include these in driver training? Obviously, it's a young crowd. You have to start somewhere to educate. That's something you have said on to that, possibly included in driver training portion?
I'm sure we could. I'm sure we could. Another conclusion is possibly maybe education in grade schools as part of a phys ed class, perhaps. I don't know, but education, I think. I mean, infrastructure is very important. I don't want to discount infrastructure in any way, but I think education is also very important. Any other questions? Yes.
I want to thank you for putting this together, because I was one of the folks that brought up a question about it when the comprehensive report was given to us a couple of years back, so I appreciate the work that went into this. The map that you displayed there that showed the locations of the bike crashes, that's not included in our handout. Is that available somewhere? Is that online? Or?
Yes, that will be online, and I would be happy to, if you just send us an email and say you want to, it's in PDF, I'd be happy to send you one of our sponsors.
We could even zoom in on a particular area if you'd like, too.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. It's just from what I can see from here, there were some areas that were, they were quite clearly concentrated, and as you had indicated in the report, there's hardly any crashes on the recreational trails. The crashes are in places where the motor vehicles and the bicycles are both trying to use the same space at the same time. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, if you would let us know how we navigate to get that that map, that's important. It would have been nice to have it included in this. But I could see how it would be better digitally so we can focus in on it.
I think maybe what we'll do is we'll just send everyone, we'll just send a copy of it out electronically to everyone.
That'd be great, thanks. We have a fairly large biking community in Hudson, and it's growing. We're trying to make as many, we have a connectivity plan, a trail plan, especially for the adolescents, not so much for the road warriors that are out early on Saturday and Sunday mornings. But one of the things that disturbs us is the significant lack of citations when there is a bike vehicle accident. There's just a national report done, and I don't know if you could augment this report on that issue, that even in the most injured, even in death, it's very seldom a citation to the driver. That's what the report said. I'll have to dig it out now. I was shocked about that. Not even thinking about it, that it would be. In any of this, did that have of your study, did that have any relationship with why there is such an attitude about lack of citations for those things, when obviously the bikers are taking the brunt of the injuries?
To be quite honest with you, I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware of the lack of citations.
It's significant.
I'm not discounting it. It's just something that just didn't seem to show up.
We'll look into that, Mayor. I will say that when I was sharing some of this information as we were doing preliminary analysis, I shared some of this with some bike advocates, and they had felt in the national literature, and that I think bears out what you just said, that they felt there was a significant bias against cyclists to begin with, and that even when people were cited, that the officers tended to be more sympathetic to the motor vehicle driver, perhaps just because that's their experience more, being the one in the car and not the one on the bike. So while we didn't find data on that, I think we would like to research it more and look into, if you're maybe even able to send us some of the information you have, that would be a help.
I will I'll try to rediscover that.
Sure.
Piece. I shared it with a number of our cycle enthusiasts in town so that they could pass along to the
good time
cycle club.
We'll have to count. We're going to count how many go by.
Number two.
At any rate, so that they could forewarn the cyclist, but at the same time, and I'm a cyclist, and there is a significant lack of courtesy on the part of vehicles, even when we provide the bike lanes. And if they're not being sighted, okay, now, I'm surprised that most of the accidents here, the vast majority are cyclists running into vehicles, but also the 40% of 60 and under, then that changes the whole scope here of paying attention. But I have had a number of incidents where just the attitude, tailgating cyclists, zooming up on them, all sorts of stuff. I mean, that's pretty aggressive. But then just the ignorance. And we're putting up signs saying, just to remind people, share the road. Now, that's in every driver training and everything else, but people don't want to do that. So if they're not being cited, I think that's an issue. I mean, a very big issue. When it's, with all due respect, it's vehicles that have the most capability of injuring the cyclist versus the reverse of that. So
absolutely.
It's the rule of lug nuts, man.
What's that?
It's the rule of lug nuts. Whoever has the most lug nuts wins.
Well, sometimes the biggest two.
Okay.
Moving on.
Any other questions? Just to follow up on that, it appeared from the way you described your data collection is the information that you got from the Ohio Department of Public Safety was just reports where citations had been issued. Is that accurate?
No, it was every incident where a bike was involved.
Where a crash report?
Where the law enforcement did a crash report was generated.
So one of the issues could be that perhaps crash reports aren't being generated as often as they should.
There are probably many times when these things happen, and both parties say, let's just forget and let's move on. I mean, obviously we wouldn't have a report from an incident like that, so we don't know about it. But what I don't know, what you just, the seed that was just planted to think about is every time there's a police report, I don't know if there's a citation. I mean, I'm just not sure if every police report generates a citation.
Right, and with the data that you have, having the reports that should indicate,
yeah, you'll have it on there.
Whether,
yes,
whether
I can look at that.
Just can carry
yes,
it over.
I can go back and look at that. Yes.
It's another interesting, possibly psychological effect. I'm a cyclist also, and nearly had a bad collision with a car that ran a stop sign. And I actually caught up to the lady at a stoplight and said a few things to her.
Then she ran over.
She was quite surprised I caught her. But I had a little extra speed coming behind me. But the thought is, why didn't I report her? Why didn't I take down the license number and report her rather than confront her? Which could have been more harmful to my safety than the wrong person.
Oh, I had a similar situation. I got cut off. It was in a neighboring community. I won't name the community. And clearly it was very visible, and I also did a chase. And I could tell her.
Road rage.
No, actually, by the time I caught her, I was wrapped. But just to say, do you realize what happened back there? So she was very apologetic. She went by just saying, pay attention. I was looking at you. And then you make that turn. Anyway, I don't know.
There's things that
happens.
There was just one more thing I wanted to mention. I forgot to mention this, and I just thought of it. Out of the 331 crashes, we think that about 12 of them happened on highways where there were bike lanes.
Really?
We're trying to update our inventory on where bike lanes are, but we think about 12 of them happened where there were bike lanes. But the one thing I want to try to stress is just a lot of these crashes, especially the ones where the bike rider was faulted, is children. You know, it's a six-year-old, you know, darting out in front of traffic, and it's not necessarily the more responsible riders. I mean, they also are involved in crashes, but those are the ones more where the driver, the vehicle driver, is at fault. But this is one type of crash where children are, you know, involved in the cause. So I just, you have to keep that in mind too. Any other questions?
Thank you, David. Okay, item number 6, resolutions. Under number 6, it's attachment 6A in your agenda, your package. Resolution 2013-17, conformity determination and concurrence with the revised air quality conformity analyses for the Cleveland-Akron air quality area necessitated by the amendment to Transportation Outlook 2035 and fiscal year 2014 to 2017 TIP. That's quite a mouthful. Phyllis.
I'll make a motion.
I'll try to make it brief. Resolution 2013-17, that's an attachment 6A, includes basically a summary of the air quality conformity analyses to reflect proposed amendments to NOAACA and AMATS's transportation plans and transportation improvement programs to include 4 projects in Cuyahoga County and 1 project in Summit County, that being the I-271 widening project in Macedonia. The 5 projects are part of ODOT's major new capacity program and new turnpike revenue approved by the TRAC and the Ohio Turnpike and Infrastructure Committee. Since AMATS and NOAACA are in the same 8-county non-containment air quality area, transportation conformity determination is required for an amendment of regionally significant projects that add capacity to the region's transportation system. NOAACA has prepared conformity analyses that are shown in Table 2 for the 8-hour ozone and the people that matter air quality standards to reflect changes to the region's transportation conforming network for the amended projects. The analyses conclude that total regional emissions for each air pollutant remains below the set budgets. This resolution establishes concurrence with the results of the conforming analyses that demonstrate the amended projects do not interfere with Cleveland-Akron's non-attainment area. And so the staff recommends approval of this resolution. Are there any questions?
I need a motion.
So moved.
Second. Any discussion?
Other than the conformity, is it just saying that we're going to conform to what the federal regulations are? What is that?
Yeah, it's saying that these projects, when constructed, will not pollute over and above what we're allowed to pollute per the EPA regulation. So it doesn't say that they're not polluting at all, but they fall within the limits that we're allowed.
Okay. Obviously, I hope everybody supports this and make sure they stay within the standards. But just as a point of interest, I just read this morning that they, in the major cities in China, they are building air quality clinics to treat their citizens because of the severe air quality issues that they have in most of the industrial cities in China. I don't think we've ever come to that quite that point. But at the same time, there's also a value of having our flat topography. I just got back from Salt Lake City, and it is rated as the air quality dirtiest city in the United States. Of all of its beauty, and that's because, of course, it's the mountains around it and the hills, but it's because of the traffic, the pollution, and all of those other things. And it is, as I was talking with a physician out there, respiratory diseases are skyrocketing in this pristine area because of that. So it pays us to follow these guidelines and do what we can and to advocate for good quality air for the quality of life in this area. So I share that, and I thank you very much, Connie.
Thank you, Mayor. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Resolution 2013-18, approving amendment number 1 to the Transportation Outlook 2035 to add I-271 widening. Krista?
Hi, thank you. This is kind of a follow-up to the conformity determination by Phillips. This is an amendment update to Transportation Outlook 2035, our regional transportation plan, to add the 271 widening project. The reason that it has to be amended is for the project to receive federal transportation funds. It must be on our regional transportation plan. The amendment was requested by ODOT, and it is I-271 in Macedonia from 4 lanes to increase it to 6 lanes from north of State Route 8 to the Cuyahoga County line. As with all regional transportation plan amendments, it has to have fiscal constraint, demonstrate public involvement, environmental justice, and air quality conformity. We had two public meetings to allow time for the public to review and comment on those. They were both at the downtown Akron Public Library. We received one public comment concerning adding a capacity project while there are other preservation needs in our region. The project demonstrates fiscal constraint due to state turnpike bonds. It also demonstrates air quality conformity, as we just approved for resolution 23-17. And it was also reviewed for environmental justice, and there were did not impose any disproportionately high adverse impacts. Resolution 2013-18 approves the amendment to Transportation Outlook 2035, and with that, the staff recommends approval, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I need a motion.
Second?
Second.
Question.
Any discussion?
This amendment is an additional $57 million.
It's approximately $61 million, but it is covered. The I believe second page of the memo shows fiscal constraint, but it is fiscal constraint through state turnpike bonds funding.
But that amount, $57 million, or what proportion is that amendment adds a significant amount to everything else that we've already approved, right?
Correct. We're adding that project into the plan. So that amount will increase the amount that Transportation Outlook recommends.
And the reason we're amending the plan is because when we did the plan, we didn't forecast this revenue to be available, and then subsequently the state of Ohio authorized the bonds on the turnpike, and that's what provided funding, and that's why it's in our what we call fiscal constraint, because there is money available for the project.
So the $60 million that's coming in is not coming out of any other project that we've already approved?
No, it's coming, it's new, money, basically.
Any other discussion? I have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes. Item C, it's attachment 6C, resolution 2013-19, approving amendment number 5 to the Transportation Improvement Program fiscal year 2014 to 2017 to add I-271 widening, and we will need a motion on that. Victor.
Thank you. So this is the last step in adding this project to our documents. It's from the DMP 271 project. Just to reiterate, it's in Macedonia with 4 to 6 lanes from just north of State Route 8 to the Cuyahoga County line, and it's a $60-some million project with state funds and staff recommend approval.
So moved.
Second.
Any discussion? Motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion passes. Thanks, Victor. Oh, you're up again. Item D, this would be attachment 6D,
Resolution 2013-20, approving amendment number 6 to the Transportation Improvement Program fiscal year 2014 to 2017 to add Aurora Safe Routes to School Plan, Barberton SRTS, Ellsworth Hill SRTS, and Rittman SRTS, revise the schedule of Hiram Village sidewalks and Howe Avenue, and cancel State Route 619 Worcester Road.
Thank you. There's four new projects in this amendment to TIP. They're all safe routes related to safe routes to school projects. The first one's in Aurora. That's actually the safe routes to school plan. That's scheduled in 2015. The next three are infrastructure projects. The first one's in Barberton, Barberton Elementary School. That's scheduled in 2016. The next one in Ellsworth Hill is in the city of Hudson, scheduled in 2015. And then the last one is in Rittman. That's scheduled in 2015. Next two projects, Hiram Village Sidewalks and Howe Avenue. Based on the project review meeting we had a few weeks ago, these projects will be completed back 1 year. The sidewalk project was from 15 to 16, and then Howe Avenue goes right away. Construction will be back 1 year into 16 and 17. And the last project, 619 Worcester Road in Barberton. This is an AMAP funded project that we agreed to fund. This committee agreed to fund a couple years ago. Since that time, ODOT has the larger I-76 project in the same area. This project will be a part of that larger project, so ODOT's going to do it as well as pay for it. So approximately $1.9 million in MSSP funds will then be available back to the overall funding program, and that will simply go to the funding available for new projects. With that, also, the staff recommends approval of this resolution.
I need a motion.
Move. Second.
Any discussion? None. With a motion and a second, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Item E, Resolution 2013-21, approving amendment number 7 to the Transportation Improvement Program fiscal year 2014 to 2017 to add and revise funds in FY 2014 for part of capital projects.
Part is asking the Federal Transit Administration funds to increase to cover the construction of their compressed natural gas treatment facility at their main headquarters. The project will remain funded at 80% federal share of total cost, increased to $1.4 million. Part is also asking to revise their current purchase of 5 small buses in fiscal year 2014 as well. These purchase of 2 support vehicles equipment. The project cost declines from $375,000 to $200,000, also funded at 80% federal share. Staff is requesting approval of resolution 2013-21 and the TAC and CIC vote for recommended approval.
I need a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. And we come to other business. Report of the 2014 nominating committee. This is my last meeting as chair, not my last meeting, but I have to show up. I'm mandated to show up for a reason. There were two other members of the nominating committee, Mayor Bika from Ravenna and Mayor Bashara from Richfield. We got together and decided that the vice chair, who is Mayor Dave Klein from Talmadge, should be chair next year, and he has agreed to do that. And Gene Roberts from Kent has agreed to be the vice chair. I don't need anything for that.
Just need just a motion,
need a motion
to close the nominations and then elect them.
So moved.
So I need a motion.
Mr. Harrison made the motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? You don't get to vote.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. Gene?
Thank you, and thank you for doing this. It's really... I must say, it's a very easy job. And
great staff.
Great staff. And actually, I have
I just want to make mention of the work that Carrie Crater does in organizing all of these meetings. And any questions I ever had on any information, Carrie has given it to me, and he's done it in a very timely fashion. And so, Carrie, I would like you to accept this.
Oh, gosh.
As a token of my appreciation for all of the hard work that you do.
Thank you.
Carrie never gets to talk up there at the podium. He does a really good job.
Starbucks.
Do you go to Starbucks?
I will now.
He has to listen to his boss talk a lot.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. And Connie, please. The meeting calendar, Jason.
Okay, this one is attachment 7B, and Curtis had mentioned earlier in his report that we will be here next year at Quaker Station. I hope you find the accommodations helpful. If you guys do have things that you notice that we could do better on here, from how the room's set up to anything else, don't hesitate to ask. The calendar is here for your perusal and approval, and with that, we would ask for a motion for approval.
I'd move to approve.
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. We have a visitor, and I need to apologize. I have a meeting at 3 o'clock, so if I need to sneak out early, I apologize, Hunter. It's not you.
And I was going to say, before we let Connie sneak out, similarly, I wanted to present her with a plaque to commemorate her service. Connie, thank you
Jason.
So much for serving.
Absolutely.
And I just want to say, serving on a lot of committees and boards myself, it gives me a lot better appreciation, especially for what you do as chair, as well as I wanted to thank all of you for your attendance, for your participation. I know that all of you have day jobs and make a special effort to be here, and it really does help us to have the feedback. And in the end, it's about you. You're the elected officials that make the decisions. So thank you in particular, Connie, and thanks all of you. And I'll just do a brief introduction. I know this has been a long meeting already, so I'll be brief. But I did want to introduce Hunter Morrison, who's the director of the Northeast Ohio Sustainable Communities Consortium. I think many of you are aware that AMATS is one of the founding members of the consortium, along with Summit County and some of the other governments and other metropolitan planning organizations in the region. We got a grant back in 2010 from the Department of Housing and Urban Development to put together a sustainable communities plan for a 12-county region of Northeast Ohio. So to date, there's been a lot of data collection and analysis. There's been some building of collaborative capacity amongst entities in the region, and then more recently a draft policy framework has been put together based on the work of the consortium. So Hunter's going to specifically address that, and we will have time for questions when he's finished, or I imagine Hunter, even if people have a question throughout, they can raise their hand. So the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jason. And before you run out.
Yes, Hunter.
Before you run out. I just wanted to thank you and Jason and Herb Curran and your staff. I know Rich Jensen has been participating. Aaron Grum, you've been participating. This is an effort across a region of 4 million people with 4 million public planning organizations and an FCO Council of Governments. It's a very ambitious idea, and it's because we've had the dedicated support, interest, and engagement of PMS and the staff, as well as the other NPOs, and I think we've made considerable progress. And I get to your meeting, but I just wanted to publicly thank you for the leadership you've shown, and Jason as well, to you. One of the things we did about a year ago, when we were going through some growing pains, because this is a new organization, is we created a technical steering committee, which has the four metropolitan planning organization directors and Joe Havitt, NEFCO. These are the agencies that represent the elected officials across the 12-county region. that are familiar with the challenges of doing long-range planning. And I think it provided enormous guidance in crafting this work with the intention of bringing it back to you and the other organizations and the other member groups of the 33-member consortium for their concurrence in approving this work in February, our February board meeting. We just met the other day in our meeting to release the findings, which I'm going to go through. What is being passed out right now is a brief summary, in a two-page summary of what we're going to see. There's an enormous amount of additional information, which will be on the web, as well as a summary of what Vibrant Neo is and what we're about. Let me talk to you a little bit about the process. We're about the business of developing not a plan, but a framework for the future, a framework looking out out to 2040, which we hope you will find useful as you do your long-range transportation planning, air quality planning, and work in your individual jurisdictions to deal with the challenges ahead. The process really went into high gear about a year ago, as we engaged a national local consulting team to work with our staff and a wide range of volunteers we engaged. Starting in January, we focused on the question of where are we headed currently. And we looked at the last 20 years of information in Northeast Ohio about population, employment, households, and abandonment and development, and then projected those out. Because of the work of AMATS and SCATS and the other NGOs, we had, in the prior year, developed a very unique, first of its kind, parcel-based land use map for all of Northeast Ohio for 1.8 million parcels. And with the help, I think, of the AMATS team that put together your connecting communities, developed also a methodology for aggregating and generalizing the zoning maps of 400 jurisdictions in a way that we could then look at each one of these parcels and the communities and track the change over a 20-year period and then project that out using a scenario planning process for the next 25. But a series of meetings in April and May where we discussed that with people across Northeast Ohio and asked them, this is the trend, where do you want to go? What are some of the concerns and issues, and where should we invest our time, effort, and money? We from that first meeting, we then developed three additional scenarios based on a couple of variations. First, we asked the question, what happens if our relatively modest population and employment growth over the last 20 years grows at the national rate? We've been subperforming in both categories for some period of time. What happens if we were to maintain our market share of population, stop losing congressmen every 10 years? What happens if our economy performed at the national level as the Team NEO group has suggested with effort we could do? How does that play itself out on the land and our water and air quality and on the fiscal health of our communities? And then we ask the question, well, what happens if we can do things differently? If we cease to put almost all of our energies in new development at the edges and get more balance. Under both circumstances of modest population and employment growth and more robust growth. We took that back out to 10 open houses across Northeast Ohio in July and August. And from that input and the reactions, we came back out with a framework, a draft framework, asking the question, where do we want to go? That came again in October. Where we are right now is we presented to our board Vision Environment and Products presentation. Each one of the MBOs has asked that we present that to their boards because we want to be in a position in February, if at all possible, for our board members to adopt this and take it back to you as a working and a living document and data for your use. Let me boil it all down to the challenges we face. With modest population and employment growth over the last 20 years, and continued physical development mostly at the edges, what we've seen and what we're likely to see in the future is increasing abandonment, mounting infrastructure costs due to the need to build new infrastructure at the edges, and increasing transportation costs when we move further away. What you see on this map is, again, a boiled out of an enormous amount of information, but in the lower left corner, these are the numbers that we're wrestling with for Northeast Ohio with the business, with the trend line going out to 2040. Less than 100,000 new residents, almost 277,000 new homes to meet changing market demand. Basic supply and demand, we're going to have, in all likelihood, up to 175 housing units to demolish over that period of time. That's about 18 housing units a year or day in and day out, 365 for that period of time. It's about $1.5 billion that would have to be raised to demolish. But most importantly, in many respects, what we're seeing is the hollowing out of our legacy cities, our core cities, particularly Cleveland and the Youngstown Warren area, but we think increasingly the challenge is also Akron and Canton, which have done a very good job of keeping ahead of the trend, and Lorain and Elyria. And additional growth into Eastern Lake Lorain County, in the Medina County, Southern Summit, Southern Portage, Northern Portage, and into Geauga and Lake County, which will require, again, additional infrastructure to support them. This is a big picture of what happens if we continue on the path ahead. Now, I've been involved in a lot of planning processes over the years. This is the first one where we've been able really to look at the fiscal aspect, the financial aspects to our communities of different scenarios. This chart tells us some very interesting and disturbing things. All of you know that the state of Ohio requires we balance our budget. The zero line there reflects a balanced budget. The dots, the small dots, reflect the counties. We've been able to look at the pattern in each one of our 12 counties and the 700 taxing jurisdictions within them. And what we've done here is aggregate those that information by county. So I can't tell you what happens at Avon, particularly over today or into the future, but I can tell you what happens in Lake Silverade County. Look today, across the 12 counties, we're basically in balance, a little below the line. That reflects the fiscal stress I think we all feel. And the counties are close, fairly close together. Some are doing pretty well, some are doing less well. Going up to 2040, what we're seeing is a downward cost pressure of about 34%. That does not mean that everybody's budget is going to be, we're all going to be in bankruptcy in 2040, but it does suggest that over a period of time, the experience that we've been having of having to do more with less of facing budget challenges each and every year continues, and rather dramatically. The other thing we see is a widening spread of the counties from a minus roughly 15% to a minus over 65%. And what we see is the best performing county in 2040 performs worse than the worst performing county today. Again, when we get into the model and say what's driving these, it's the high cost of new infrastructure at the edges, the high rates of abandonment at the cores, and relatively stagnant unemployment based on past trends. So we presented that information to folks at the meetings in the spring, asked them to play planner. This is one of the 60-plus maps, mapping tables we had, where we gave people the yellow dots representing the 275,000 76,000 new housing units in a typical low-density suburban fashion, and said, where do you go? And you can trade. You don't have to put it all in that. You can do something else if you want. And what we found was that people were interested in really looking at compact development. We then presented information in the July meetings about the impacts of the different scenarios. And from that, this information, as well as the work of our 33-member board, the technical steering committee, which is the five MPO and COG directors, seven caucuses on subject matter areas, in terms of transportation, housing, and the like, work streams, which involved about 120 subject matter experts, the vision sessions, which we did about 27 of those, and then emails. All that is boiled down to recommendations and initiatives. This material is going to be completed in January. The full report comes out in February. There'll be an executive summary and roadmap and presentations to this body, but also if you want us to present to any other groups, we will have presentations for professional design professionals, planning professionals, elected officials, and the public. So let's talk about what what boiled out down from all the input we had. The broad and overarching objective that we heard across the region was promoting investment in our established communities. Some of you may have been involved about 8 or 9 years ago with Voices and Choices, and among the things that we heard then was concerned with the condition of our existing communities. And we heard this very clearly as we drilled down on the land issue, land planning issues in Northeast Ohio. The second objective, which fits very much in your bailiwick, is developing the regional economy with accessible employment opportunities. Typically, that's used in talking about workforce development and job readiness and helping people get ready to get a job. What we've been focusing on is a little bit different and equally important. It's asking the question, how do you get to the job? And what we're finding is not only are the jobs locating further and further away from our transit lines and our historic centers of employment, but we're incentivizing them through SBA, through tax abatements, through sewer extensions. So it's harder and harder to get to work with anything but a private automobile. And this appears to have impact, particularly on two sectors, our production workforce and the sort of millennial Gen X workforce that prefers not to have a problem. The third overall objective is improving our regional fiscal health. And again, I don't have to tell anybody in this room about the impact of the cuts in local government funds, inheritance tax, and the changes in Washington in terms of the ability of local governments to rely on higher levels of government for support. And increasingly, we're on our own. Enhancing our regional transportation network and looking at it as a network that serves the region as a whole, as well as the individual counties that support it. Protecting our soil, water, air, and ecologically sensitive areas. This was the number one priority in the online polling we did, one of our engagement tools, in 10 of the 12 counties. It's a very real issue for many people, including counties like Mahoning County and Trumbull County, where given their interest in the shale gas and oil play, you might have expected something somewhat different. But it's very clearly a top priority across the region. Another thing we found as we went across the region is everybody's got pride points. Everybody's got locations that they take Aunt Sally, who comes from San Diego, to show them. We cultivate and celebrate and leverage our local assets and places of public value. All across Northeast Ohio, particularly in the historically industrial communities like Summit County and with Akron and Stark County with Canton and Cleveland, Cuyahoga County and Youngstown and Mahoning County and Lorain, Elyria, Lorain County, we have historically invested significantly in parks and open space. In addition, we have the national park. What we hear was that over time we need to expand and link our park and open space network. And finally, preserving and valuing our farmland as a regional economic asset and not as land for future development. Increasingly, the interest in local agriculture is bubbled to the surface, but also valuing our land for its productive purpose, particularly our prime farmland, is a way to moderate our development patterns. I want to get down again to sort of the broad themes. What we hear is the desire to strengthen our established communities, create a diverse range of neighborhoods and place types to meet changing market demands. We've built mostly larger and larger housing further and further away, missing markets like millennials who want to live close to town, like aging baby boomers, like the range of households that increasingly characterizes metropolitan areas. Offer a wider range of transportation options, including bus and rail and bike and walking. Invest in our legacy cities, our historic cores like Akron and Cleveland and Youngstown, but also the smaller ones like Barberton and the like, and our established cities and towns and villages, but the Hudsons and the...
did put Hudson.
You did.
You have a very persistent board member representing the interests of Enes and our boards in Bear Creek. So, yes, representing Hudson and Hubbard and Medina, places that have deep histories and physical integrity, and preserving the agricultural value and natural characteristic of our landscape. You'll see as you go online that we've identified areas which we think are at risk of future abandonment and need to be focused on, and areas that where we see risk of additional infrastructure costs will be here and also to focus on. And you will also see a strong commitment to advancing the effort to link and leverage our communities using our transit systems. Based on those goals, we've identified themes and recommendations. There are 8 objectives, which we went through, 4 themes, 9 recommendations, and 41 implementing recommendations or initiatives. One point we want to make loud and clear in answer to anybody who thinks that this is somehow a top-down approach that's being imposed by some group on anybody else. We're very clear, and the document so states, that this is not a one-size-fits-all solution. It's a very complex region of 12 counties, 5 different planning agencies, 400 municipalities and townships, and over 700 taxing jurisdictions. We need to be cognizant of the fact that we're a very diverse place. We also need to acknowledge and have that some of the initiatives will not be applicable in all parts of this region. Part of what we're suggesting is this is a bit of a menu for advancing sustainability and the resilience of the virus in your communities. Because the bottom line is the decision to implement the individual initiatives will be made at the local level. They'll be made in your city councils, they'll be made at your county councils and your county commissions, they'll be made in groups like this composed of local elected officials. This we are advising and we are providing information, but it's the responsibility of local government to take the action. So let's talk about the themes. The first one is strengthening our established communities. The recommendations that come out of that first is and these are not ranked, but we sort of numbered. The first one is focusing new residential and commercial development on sites within established communities. What we mean by that is first projects like First and Main and Hudson. It means using the land that's already been developed. It means the sort of development you see here in Akron. Use the land where we have the service and put people and businesses back on. Talking to this group of people who know the language of transportation planning, I think the second one, which is going to be a little wonky, I hope makes sense. Developing a robust network of regional job centers connected by multiple transportation corridors within and between counties. What we simply mean is focus your job activities in ways that we can serve you and serve those jobs and get people to work using not only automobile but transit, biking, walking, different means, and locating jobs increasingly close to where people live. We also are very well aware of the brown seals challenge in Northeast Ohio, as a historically industrial area, so we're recommending pursue the remediation, assembly, marketing, and redevelopment of abandoned properties at both the local and the regional level. Most of this is done at the local level, at cities and counties. We're suggesting the region has a vested interest in getting these properties, particularly the larger ones, the regularly shaped ones, the ones that can be put back into use if they're clean, back onto the market. Encourage a higher frequency of mixed-use development and a range of diverse affordable housing options. Again, as we look across the region and as we look nationwide, there's an increasingly niche and diverse market for housing. Our development communities respond to it, and so do our cities. Now, there are many examples in the AMATS area of exactly what we're talking about. The development in Hudson, the development in Kent, the investment that Akron and Summit County made in Goodyear, the investment that's been historically made at the University of Akron and Kent State to encourage people to live close to campus. What we're suggesting as we look at this region is, again, and there's a whole set of far more detailed maps for use, is we face challenges in our core cities, particularly Akron, Canton, the older parts of each and every one of our cities. We call those asset risk areas. We face areas, we identified areas which need that targeted investment over time to maintain their viability and competitiveness. One of the strategic investment areas, and we've identified areas where the patterns of outward migration suggest that we're going to incur additional infrastructure costs, and we're calling those cost risk areas. We've also identified the sewer urbanized area, which is where there have been commitments to develop. what we're suggesting very strongly is, as communities and as a metros and as a region, we need to look very carefully at where we're spending our money, what's happening, and how do we minimize the cost and increase the benefits of the development that we have, whether it's rebuilding on the land we have or extending our benefits. So we're suggesting encouraging infill investment on existing sites in our legacy cities and existing towns, customizing strategies to address specific local challenges, expanding traditional housing options, and providing a range of housing types, but accounting fully for the long-range cost of building and maintaining. The tendency to assume that the infrastructure will follow is increasingly difficult as you wrestle with your fiscally constrained tips and long-range planning. The second is increased transportation choice. I want to get into this in a little more detail. We're talking about enhancing and coordinating the region's rail and bus services and enhancing walking and cycling as a transportation option to increase regional mobility and improve quality. What we're basically saying, I know you're aware of what we did years ago through Summit County Metro and GCRTA and Stark County Transit and a number of others, is to look at a commuter rail map commuter rail plan connected down our core communities. We're suggesting that that's still an idea that may pan out, but it's pretty expensive, and that what we need to be looking at, and you see this in blue, the near term is linking our region with express bus. Some of this is already in place. Some of it is in place, but it's only one directional. I know from personal experience, you get from Akron to Cleveland for a job, it's very difficult going the other way. You cannot get from Youngstown to Akron for a job. You cannot get from Lorain and Elyria to Cleveland for a job. So what we're looking at is suggesting a bi-directional express bus system that works with and connects our county-level transit agencies to provide seamless service two ways. And frankly, the Akron-Cleveland connection is the strongest of all the routes. And underneath that, the best routes, which we think are underutilized, as we found about 8,000 acres of vacant and commercial and industrial land alongside within 1,200 feet of the best routes in the region. So the initiatives, each one of our recommendations has a set of initiatives, but the ones that really apply here are, number one, investing in a network of bi-directional public transit connections between our major job centers. Two is creating a network of high-frequency express and local transit routes, prioritizing development, infill development along those routes. Don't run your buses past empty lots. In the short term, rely on high-performing bus routes and create new routes. In the long term, take the commuter rail route that makes sense. Number three is coordinate the region's transit system for joint marketing, information technology, and fair media, including information regarding private transit resources. I made this presentation earlier in the week to PCRTA. They're already announcing, in cooperation with the other transit agencies in the region, the action already on Initiative 5.3. And finally, evaluate the condition of existing rail trackage and crossing. Be mindful of the logistic requirements on the freight side. On the other one is enhancing recommendation six on walking and cycling. We're suggesting expanding the existing bike lane and trail system and connecting it to the regional transit system and hubs throughout the facilities. Repairing existing sidewalks and crosswalks and adding new ones as needed, particularly along the fixed route bus system. Promoting complete streets and collaborating with school districts and local communities to further safe routes to school. I know that I'm speaking to the choir here because you're addressing today issues like safe routes to school. You've been leaders in complete streets. What we're saying is these issues, which usually fall within the transportation space or the transit agency space, need to be ramped up to be region-wide investment priorities. And our local business community and elected leaders who aren't involved in groups like this need to understand the importance. The third priority or theme is preserving and protecting natural resources. And again, we're suggesting preserving our natural resource for the future, doing this by developing a regional approach to protecting air, water, and soil quality. We see some mismatches in terms of our existing structure of watersheds, opportunities across the region to collaborate further, building on the good work of NEFCO and Eastgate and NOAACA and AMATS and SCATS, trying to work across jurisdictional lines to deal with environmental issues that do not respect those lines. And finally, supporting sustainable agricultural and local food systems in Northeastern Ohio. Again, Summit, Portage County have been leaders in this area, particularly as we looked at the national park system that everybody wants to connect to, but also at the metro park level. What we're suggesting is building off of our strengths. As we cross across the region, there are two places that everybody wants to get to. One is Lake Erie, and the other is the Cuyahoga Valley National Park. Well, how can we connect by bikeways and trails and strategic acquisitions and recurring corridors? How can we connect these assets so you can get from Cleveland to Youngstown to Pittsburgh to Washington, D.C. on the trail that goes to Pennsylvania? You can get from Youngstown and Mill Creek Metro Park to the National Park through the park network of Suffolk County. How do we do this? By developing a robust network that connects the dots. And finally, promoting collaboration and efficiency. And again, increasing the collaboration among the region's government agencies to expand information sharing and find more cost-effective means to provide essential services. And you know that the state of Ohio has funded efforts to encourage collaboration, a group led by the Fund for Our Economic Future, Efficient Gov Now, has been doing the same. We see an opportunity that we've learned together from our work for expanding information sharing, aligning transportation system models, maintaining scenario planning, and other databases for collaborative use in making decisions that respect the fact that we're increasingly an economic region as well as an environmental region that incorporates these communities, and we need to figure out ways to collaboratively plan together. So putting it together, what we see is a plan that is articulated in much greater detail that suggests in targeting our investments and favoring our investments in our established communities, running the full range of places from the legacy cities to the established cities and towns to the existing suburbs where we've already made that investment. Focusing also on assets such as our Western Missouri town centers like Hudson and Dinah and Elyria and Warren, which are historic and very unique centers around the traditional New England style region. Focusing on the innovation zones anchored by our three urban state universities, Cleveland State, Youngstown State, and University of Akron, and our largest private research university, Case Western Reserve. And build off of those within a mile of those campuses. We have a lot of smart people. We have a lot of people who want to walk and drive. And we have the opportunity to leverage that vitality. Focus also on our emerging cultural districts like Kent and the Waterloo District and up in Gordon Square in Cleveland and downtown Kent, which is emerging as a regional leader in using entertainment. Identifying our industrial waterfronts and reinforcing those are the deep water ports which serve our industry. How do we make sure that the rail and road networks are there to them that work, but they're also increasing the recreation areas, and we see an opportunity to balance both the model of that being flats, but we also see that in Lorain and Ashtabula in particular. And finally, stop calling the good sites that could be repositioned brownfields and call them new industrial opportunities. If you go to Youngstown, Ohio, and look at what Vallourec, a French-owned Steel Tube Manufacturing, has done on the old Ohio Works, putting almost $750 million on a site that was cleared, and with about $20 million of stimulus, it leveraged that site investment and about 600 jobs. There are sites around the region, and we've identified those which are of a scale with the infrastructure assets in place that need to be cleaned. And the patterns that we're seeing, the policies we're seeing both out of the state and the federal government don't fully recognize that. We're a region that historically has manufactured things. There's evidence that segment of our economy is showing increasing health. Let's look together, not just in Youngstown or Akron or Cleveland. Let's look together at those assets and see what we can do. Let's bring them back online. And again, as we look at your area, of some Portage counties, we see opportunities identified, which again are much more explicitly noted, but really focusing on bringing the region together around the investments we've made, the assets we have, and the future we share. So where are we? We just took this document or this document and information for all the recommendations and initiatives and the backup to our board on the 17th and are in the process again of refining that, presenting it to board organizations like your own, with the goal that at the end of February we would like to be in a position to call for a vote to adopt and approve this vision framework of products. And to go forward, and I've been informed by all of our board members that they have their own process to go through. Jason has asked me to speak to you. So last week, I think we did the TAC and the Citizens Involvement Committee, Citizens Advisory Committee, and today the board. But we really wanted to allow ample time for you all to mull it over. So January and February is the time that we're out and about. And Bill, if you want us to, or Rich, if you want us to present to your boards or anything else in this time period, Jeff Adderley and I and a number of other board members, that's our job. So give Jeff a call, give me a call, or get me an email, and we'll come and make the presentation. So the people see what's out there to us, been proposed, see how they can use it to further benefit their own communities. And so when we come together in February, Jason, we'll come together with confidence and enthusiasm, because this reflects a framework that we can work with each other. So again, thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Any questions for Hunter before we break?
Hunter, you had a board meeting just 17th.
Yes.
And was there a vote on this information?
Yeah, we voted. We did vote to authorize the staff to put it out. And it's basically, it's more than a draft, but it's not a final vote. This and the supporting documentation, which again is coming forward, is there for your perusal. A great deal of time was spent taking all this information, working with our board, working with the technical steering committee, which Jason sits on, working on it with caucuses, dealing with specific subject matter areas like the transit caucus, to make sure that the recommendations made sense, were clearly worded. Respected the work that's already being done in various agencies and locations. That was aspirational, but also practical. We also clearly communicated the critical role that local governments play in this, while at the same time suggesting ways that local governments might look to the future.
So is this presentation a part of that approval to bring the information out?
Yes, there's actually
a somewhat unanimous vote, is that correct?
Yes, so there's a somewhat longer version of this, but exactly.
When will you be discussing or presenting the proposed structure of the futures?
That is a good question. As you know, Bill, this was a nonprofit corporation set up, going back actually, I think, I know Jason, you sat on, I think, Bill, you were involved as well, in the original 23-member group that came together across the region to apply for the Sustainable Communities Grant, which is funded by HUD in partnership with DOT and EPA at the national level. And we created a nonprofit corporation with a specific purpose of doing this work, using NOAC as the fiscal agent for this work. About 6 months ago now, the board acknowledge the fact that the grant runs out and that we needed to think about the future of the organization, particularly around the issue of, well, what's the role and mission having done this work. We engaged a consultant team and set up a futures committee, which met from July to basically, I think, October. They identified three mission areas. One is advising. We've got a wealth of information. Think that there's a value in advising local governments and NGOs and the others and a friend, a dashboard of what we're doing. The second was assembling, convening. I think one of the roles that we played is bringing people together. Groups like the Transit Caucus, Rich, and basically your operators, you've all been doing this, but the community development folks don't get together regularly. The parks people do a little bit. And so we've seen a real role both within subject areas, but between. Business folks don't necessarily meet with the transit folks and parks folks. And we assume. And the third is advocating. advocating on those things which are areas of regional consequence, which we can agree on, and advocating not only within our own polities locally, but also to the state and the federal government, what matters to us. Because invariably what we find is when you go to Akron and talk about the way EPA is dealing with demolition issues at Cleveland, and Youngstown, all saying the same thing. Our voice is magnified when we go together to the district of Congress, talking to EPA deputy director up there, the regional director, to talk about what their policies are going to do. Things of that nature. So those are the three areas that the board elected to accept the direction and to invest in the executive committee the responsibility for working it out going from there. And that group will start meeting in January. We have an extension that takes our staffing and this contract for the HUD to basically June 30th. And by that point in time, we hope and expect we'll continue.
So the answer to the question then is you're going to take that proposed new structure out the first 6 months of next year.
Yes.
Hopefully get an agreement amongst all of the stakeholders to embrace that or to modify and embrace it or the time frame after that.
Right, and define the funding strategies, the theme, where we can find core funding, or what sort of grants and other work should we be going after, all the stuff that you need to do in the nonprofit agency.
And I think as a board member, Mayor, my interest has been to that work that was done is kind of a framework, and we need to put some meat on the bones. And my opinion's always been we need to design whatever the organization is around the work. So first we get clear on how are we going to advocate, what are we going to advocate for, and then find us the budget and so forth that meets that need.
Well, I think it's clear from the presentation that what needs to be advocated for from the studies and the background. That the data is there, and the data should support what the answers are, what needs to be advocated for. That being said, you have to have a robust structure to have any meeting as far as advocacy is concerned, experts from across the region. And I think that's going to be a worthy task, if you may, okay?
For an
association that really has no authority but does have influence, or should have influence, but it depends if the structure, as recommended, is able to be developed and the funding accordingly.
Absolutely.
So, okay.
To Jason's point, one of the things you will see, and I didn't get into it here, are what we call the action products. We've identified here, like a dashboard, tools that local governments can use, policy recommendations at different levels of government, and finally, pilot and specific initiatives with great detail under them. So I think there's a lot of discussion that, to your point, Jason, that we need to have on of all these things. What do we do? What do we expect others to do? And how do we make that accountable? So we will be listening to a whole lot of folks over the next 7 months.
Thank you, Hunter.
And I appreciate everyone's time, and I think in the interest of time, since it's run. We thank Connie and thank all of you. You did your year's worth of service today. So happy holidays, everybody. And if you have any further questions, I'm sure Hunter will be available after the meeting.